Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for joining us. We are very excited to host you on the Label Sessions Presents podcast because you have been described as the king of real. So that's something I definitely want to kind of get into a bit today. But I think in your day job, and perhaps why you have that moniker, is you're someone who leads an ethnographic research practice. But you focus on the lived experience of the 85% of UK folks who don't live in London, which I think is just such an interesting concept. And I'd love to kind of kick off there. So maybe you could tell us a bit about yourself and what gave you the kind of a spark to found the 85%.
First of all, I mean, the name of the company is a little bit misleading. So Meet the 85% absolutely does focus on the 85% of people that live outside of London. But we do also focus on the 15% who reside within the M25. But I guess for us, it's all about proportionality. So we try and meet different people from all different walks of life. But it was just trying to kind of readdress that balance that as a country, we were a bit London-centric, and particularly some industries are a bit London-centric. But how did it come about? Well, it's been going for about a year or so. Before that, I was in advertising, communication strategist, whatever you want to call it, mostly based in London for 15, 20 years, then in Asia for nearly 6 years, and just really, really loved meeting people. The kind of inputs and outputs of a strategy job were obviously taking different inputs, some data-led, some kind of more human-led, and then applying them and kind of trying to give a client what we think would be the right thing to grow their business. And I found that the inputs were becoming a lot more interesting to me. And some of the examples were speaking to factory workers on the outskirts of Bangkok about why they were drinking a particular beer, with their outdoor barbecue meal, speaking to motorcycle mechanics across Indonesia about how they recommend one motorcycle lubricant over another, but actually going into the workshop, photographing their working environment. I just found incredibly, incredibly enriching and really useful. So about 18 months or so ago, I set up, it was essentially just a photography experiment, project, whatever you want to call it. And out of the blue came a couple of phone calls from people who was like, actually, this sounds great, Mark. How can we buy your services? So there came a bit of a fork in the road moment where I thought, actually, I'm going to do this. I'm going to finally give it a go and set up my own business. So to do that, I used a Japanese kind of thought called Ikigai, which is kind of four different areas of life, which is what are you good at? What are you passionate about? What does the world need? What can you earn money from? And I realized in my kind of previous phases of my career, I'd been over-indexing in some areas, but actually what I wanted to do was try and balance them all out. And I arrived at the Meet the 85% proposition, really. And so far, so good.
Oh, amazing. And I wonder now, because you've been on kind of both sides of the table, both from the agency side and actually kind of carrying out some of that ethnographic research and having these conversations with folk. Do you find that you bring some of your expertise and your background from your agency days a lot into your work now?
Yes, definitely. I guess most of our work is coming from, at the moment, it's coming from two different kind of centres. One is clients, so brands. So that might be marketing managers, directors within a brand, or it might be an insight person within a brand, or it's coming from agencies themselves. Because I've worked within that world for a number of years, it helps me understand their realities, kind of where the cost centers are, how things change, what it is they're going to use that money for, particularly from an agency point of view, their different cost centers of kind of marketing materials, training, etc. It helps me understand what it is they want from the research, and trying to maximize the value, because this kind of research is not the cheapest research. You can run a survey much cheaper, you can run focus groups much cheaper. But so it's really about trying to help them understand the value of it. That's the first thing. And the second thing is kind of when it comes to distilling what we found out and making it useful and valuable to a business. fundamentally, you end up with a lot of content. So there was a debrief we worked with a client on, and we debriefed a client a few weeks ago. And we had upwards of 30 hours of filmed footage of speaking to their customers. So we visited many of their customers around the UK, observed them doing things in the home, interviewed them, had them self-reporting on some aspects of their lives. And we had over 30 hours of content. Yeah, of course, a standard debrief is maybe 1 or 2 hours. So you've got to figure out how do you edit that in a fashion that is as unbiased as possible, when that is impossible to not introduce bias. But then also, how do you put together something that is interesting, engaging, valuable to them in as many different forms as possible? So as an example, there was obviously research findings. What did we find? We found out A, B, C, X, Y, Z. But then also, because of my background, it helps us spot opportunities. So in that particular debrief with that client, we shared some findings, we shared some hypotheses, we shared some opportunities for a new product line on how they could improve their packaging, on new pieces of research to improve their segmentation. I think we identified new segments that were untapped for them, so potential growth opportunities. And because of the way my brain has been kind of programmed from my past, I think that stuff comes a bit naturally to me. I think what we're learning as a business is depending on who has commissioned us, is how far do we go with that? So I'm working on another brief with an agency at the moment, and I'm liaising very closely with their very talented strategic team. Now, how far do I go as a research debriefer and kind of building strategies and suggesting leaps and hypotheses versus where do they take it over and move forward? So working closely with them to make sure that they're okay with us coming in with opportunities, hypotheses, and provocations for them to take forward with their clients.
I appreciate that you kind of talk to people across the UK, and you don't necessarily exclude people from within the M25, the 15%. But I guess with a focus on 85% that live outside of London, can you talk to me a bit around that group, around observations or insights you can share from some of the conversations you've had?
I'm loath to kind of make sweeping statements because we're talking about 67 million people in the UK. But what I will say is there are environmental differences. You know, we're in London often. I've been down, I think, every week this year already, so 5-6 times. And I lived there for 15, 20 years, and I now live in a field in Northumberland, right? There are environmental differences between the largest city in the UK versus not. And that can be anything from what a daily commute is to the obvious things like house prices, for example. There can also be the kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek examples that I think Monzo Bank released a couple of years ago, which is London is the only place where people eat more Pret than Greggs. Everywhere else, people eat more Greggs than Pret. So you get those kind of differences. I think universally across everyone, regardless of where they're from, some of the things we're picking up on, there's this sense of kind of my community before my country. And again, I am broad brushing here because obviously not everybody uses the exact same words or kind of says the same things, but there's this sense of the term my country is a bit loaded for some people. It can be seen as negative or xenophobic. And when you look at the different parts of the UK, you know, be that Scotland, Wales, England, Northern Ireland, we're quite divided, right? And again, you can go beyond the kind of sound bites of, you know, the Welsh hate the English and the Scottish hate the English and blah, blah. But actually, when you look at what's going on with Scotland and Scotland looking for a second referendum, and you look at what's going on in Northern Ireland and the potential kind of political unification over there, it's like, what are we? So we're sensing kind of people don't really know what the UK is anymore, right? We know that it's a group of different countries, but what does that actually mean? And what are the benefits of that? Particularly when 50% or so voted to be out of Europe because they didn't feel any connection to that. Yet when it comes down to community, people feel very invested in their community. And community means different things to different people. It can mean many things to different people. It can be my geographical community, so my community, my local area where I live, my housing estate, my local school, or it can cut across geographies and mean my tribe. So I met a guy recently and he was talking about my community. I said, what do you mean by my community? He said, well, it's where I live, but it's also the gay community because he was gay. So this sense of these small tribes that are kind of built around interest areas or around geographies becoming very powerful in people's lives. Whereas the kind of the whole nationwide my country is becoming something that's a bit distant from people's lives. Yet And I've shared this with a brand recently. Lots of brand strategies are national brand strategies, that they're not kind of local community brand strategies. Some brands do a good job. I think Tesco does a really good job. But I think there's something really interesting there about kind of people latching onto this thing that they call their community as opposed to their country. That exists in London and outside of London. The other thing I'll say just to finish on that is, you know, that kind of irreverent stat that I've just mentioned about Monzo and Pret and Greggs is, you know, the Meet the 85% name is kind of one of the things we first came up with. Like I said, slightly misleading because we do, of course, we speak to people in London because like everywhere, there are real people everywhere. But I think we do forget in the industry sometimes various other groups of people. So more people in the UK live in a rural location than live in London. And I can't think of any segmentation or anything I ever looked at in my 15 or 20 years that in any way kind of targeted them, reflected them. And the environmental kind of conditions in which they live in is different to a big city. And that is the reality. So what they use online shopping for is different. What they think about sustainability and driving is different. How applicable electric cars are to them is different, et cetera, just because of their living circumstance.
Oh, that's interesting. I wanted to pick your brain around any insights that you can share with us a bit around green finance, because you very kindly kind of jumped into kind of an expert session with Label Sessions with one of our clients recently. And it was very much around this kind of a green finance space. Could you speak to some of your kind of like insights to green finance?
There was a project we worked on last year for an energy company. And this was looking at what people's views around sustainable energy usage was. And when I said people, it was quite broad brush and it wasn't a huge sample size. But we decided to look at the screen for the participants in three different ways. So we spoke to a group of people who said they were not really that interested in sustainability. We spoke to a bunch of people in the middle who said they were interested in sustainability. They try and make the right choices, but they probably don't make the right choices all the time. And we spoke to people at the other end of the spectrum who stated they were into sustainability and they made active choices that kind of backed up that mindset. And what we found was really interesting, actually. So we obviously visited them, interviewed them, had a look around the homes. And this is where I think the beauty of this research really comes to the fore, because what people claim and what you actually observe can be two different things. So in the first group, the people who said, actually, you know, I don't live very sustainably for various reasons. That was very true. And we had a really interesting chat with a guy who had just retired, and we talked about sustainability. There's a bunch of other things it's worth saying, you know, and they didn't know why we were visiting them, but we'd screened them so we knew they fitted in those boxes, but they didn't know that was why we were there. And we were talking to him about kind of the sustainable choices he makes, and he was very clear. He said, look, at this point in my life now, it's not on my radar. He said, I know it should be. I don't really feel bad about it because, he said, basically, I've just retired. I've saved up what I thought was enough money to retire. Then the interest rates have gone through the roof, and I'm not sure that I have enough money to live for the rest of my life now. So he said, I'm looking kind of 5 minutes ahead of me, not 5 years ahead of me. And what was particularly poignant about that is his granddaughter was in the next room playing with his wife. So he couldn't see the link, or he didn't care about the link of, he knew that he wasn't going to kind of suffer the consequences of mass climate change, as it's obviously been kind of predicted. But even with his granddaughter in the next room, he was like, I can't think about that. I need to think 5 minutes ahead of me. In the middle group, where it was people kind of claiming that they thought about sustainability, but made some concessions to it. It's kind of exactly as you'd expected. And people were talking about making the right decisions. And the examples that people always tend to give are, well, we do our recycling and we're cutting down on plastic use. And you tend to find that people mirror back to you what's in popular culture at that particular time. So because we've all been kind of conditioned that recycling is good, because plastic is the enemy, people tend to kind of echo that stuff back when they're claiming something. Yet when we went and had a look around the house, there was plastic everywhere. And we went in the fridge, and this particular participant had claimed that, you know, she cut down on the plastic bottles in her fridge and was using reusable, you know, kind of containers. It was full of plastic bottles. You know, so she might have cut down, but it was still there, and quite a lot of it was still there. So what people claim and what they do. And on the final group, people who, you know, actually were making decisions based on sustainability, And then kind of backing that up with their decisions was interesting. But the interesting thing happened when we left those visits, we then asked them to go on what we call a prompted journey, and we wanted them to self-report on that. So we said, okay, let's pretend that your energy supplier is up for grabs. Okay, let's pretend that you want to switch energy supplier. Please, can you go through your normal journey that you would go through and send us photographs, videos, explanations on why you're doing what you're doing? Every single one of them sent back videos going on to an aggregator, then sorting by price. Not a single one of them in any of the content they sent back even mentioned the word sustainability. So what they claimed when we met them, that it was important to them, actually, by the time we kind of probed them a little bit on their self-reported journey, it was really low down the radar. And I think this gap between what people are claiming and what they do, I think is really important in this particular discussion. Because if you ask anybody in any survey about sustainability, everybody says, yes, of course we want the world to be a better place. But people actually going to lengths to then do it. And just to finish off, somewhere I met last week is millennial. And I had a good conversation with this particular participant. And I said, you know, you're known as a generation that's going to make the world a better place. And he was just on the verge of millennial Gen Z. And he interrupted me and said, it's a total privilege. Sustainability is a privilege that few can afford. And I thought, actually, it's really interesting, because what we're being told from people of his generation is, you know, that they're doing everything the right way. I want to do everything the right way.
Let me talk now and ask you a bit around, I'm quite curious, I'm nosy by nature, but how do insights really happen?
When it comes to the word insight, there are two ways to use the word. One is, and I'm guilty of this, using the word insight to explain research finding or observation or something interesting. Yet the true meaning of the word insight is about kind of something fresh, like a light bulb moment, and true insights in the world are very, very rare. But I'm guilty that in our business, we use the word insight for interesting observations. And I guess, again, a lot of that comes with experience, you know, intrigue. You know, I think you've just said, yes, you get quite nosy, quite interested. I think that's just a way of trying to find out what's going on. What I really like about what we do is I talk a lot about we unearth interesting insights, but we're not irrefutable evidence. And I'm actually really comfortable with that. I'm really comfortable that even by going to chat to one person, if the discussion guide is right and the recruitment screener is right, you can unearth so many interesting insights. And I use the word insights, observations, hypotheses, provocations. But it's not irrefutable. It's one person. And one of the things I share with clients a lot is, as human beings, we're fallible. We're contradictory. We contradict ourselves. You know, we contradict each other. We change our minds. You know, the clients don't like that a lot of the time, because they like certainty and they like boxes that they can put data into and put people into. The reality is, human nature is not like that. So this thing about finding interesting insights, you can just spot when you're in someone's home, observing them doing something, or you're having a chat with them, you can spot things that to them are really important. And equally, you spot the things that they don't point out in the home, and then you ask them about it, and there's a really interesting story behind it. Or you spot, sometimes this takes collaboration and it happens after the fact, but sometimes you leave the meetings and you kind of, you're distilling things in your brain, and then you have a look at the photographs that you've taken, and something they've said makes sense in relation to things in their home. So you end up building up this tapestry of hypotheses around that person.
How do you go about the process of interviewing people in their homes? Is it a bit weird?
It can be. The vast majority of visits we go on, the participants whose homes we go into and spend time in, and the people we spend time with, they do not know why we're there, right? So typically what happens is a client will say, this is our target audience, go and find some people, and you align their segments with a recruiter spec. What we do is we put dummy questions in there as well. So obviously, if it's I'm going to make a brand up, if it's Coca-Cola, and this is just an example, they'd obviously have some screener questions in there about age, how often they drink soft drinks, you know, what brands they prefer, etc. Now, if you ask somebody that, they know the conversation is going to be something around soft drinks. So we'll put questions in that screener about why they bank with a particular bank, or what they think about a particular political party, or what car they drive. just to try and throw them off the scent. That's kind of the first thing we do. The second thing we do when we go in is we never start a conversation talking about brands or the category that the brand is in. It's all about the reality of the people we're chatting with. And we tend to just open it up really broad and we say, okay, today's February the 12th. What have you been up to today? And what that gives us, it gives us very natural conversation doors. So if you're there to talk about a soft drink or automotive or sustainable finance, when they talk about their day, what they've been up to, it gives you little conversation points. You can kind of sway the conversation and kind of and have a bit of a meandering conversation. So when the people are recruited right, when they've got no real idea why you're there, when you put them at ease really as easily, as quickly as you can just end up having a really natural conversation with them. And then also it depends what you're asking them in the screener. So sometimes it's, we just want to have a really in-depth chat with you. Sometimes we do observation only visits where actually we don't really want to have a chat with you. We just want to observe you doing this thing, kids' mealtime, watching some TV, washing the car. We just want literally want to observe you. And we'll turn up with a bit of a kind of a film crew, but one that isn't intimidating, and film them doing it. So that they've got to know like what to expect from you when you're there. The other thing that we're learning as well is it's critical for them to understand where their content is going to be used. And we have different levels of where that content's going to be used. So different legally binding contracts, which is just behind closed doors of social or public domain. You know, we're filming people with their faces. So you've got to put them at ease. They've got to understand that. So the whole process from the first time they're interacted with by a potential recruiter, all the way through to kind of having your first conversation with them, to then the first 5 minutes are key when you're sitting down, to then the 3-4 hours. And even now we're going back to kind of repeat visit and visit people more regularly. You can start to build up a bit of an understanding with them, a bit of rapport when that happens.
How do you balance the subjective nature of, I guess, everybody's individual experiences in the interviews versus this goal of providing like an objective insight for, you know, the people that you work with? And I guess what I'm trying to get to is, how do you balance that kind of a one line off the cuff remark from a kind of interviewee into creating a provocation? How does that magic work, Mark?
I think you've got to understand what is the role of the research and who is it that you're delivering it to. So like, what is success? And even in my agency days, I used to consistently ask, what is success? What is success for this meeting? What is success for this project? What is success for this client relationship? What is success for this particular presentation? And as long as you're aligned on what success is, I feel very comfortable with that. So I'm very comfortable delivering a piece of video, an audio file that's got one person's voice in it, three people's voices in it, five people's voices in it, saying, here is something really interesting, right? I would be lying if I said that is representative of everybody, right? So we never do that. So there are different ways that we can do that. One, working with agency strategists and strategists in client organizations, they're not looking for irrefutable evidence. They're looking for interesting texture that allows them to make a leap, a strategic leap or a creative leap. Right? So if that's what they want, giving them that texture is really, really powerful. If somebody is looking for irrefutable evidence, then what can happen is that these kinds of insights, observations, can provide really interesting hypotheses. And we're doing this with a client at the moment where I think we visited only half a dozen homes. They wanted to kind of sense check something particular for their brand and category and spot where a potential gap was. To try and build more brand affinity with their audiences. So even just those six visits of their target audience have unearthed a whole bunch of different opportunities. And we've gone back to those, and then we've worked with a creative agency to create some territories, strategic creative territories. We've then gone back to those six participants and said, okay, this is where we've ended up. Again, they don't know the category or the brand. And we've then kind of had a very quick kind of dipping our toe in the water. How does this feel to you? But even then, it's not irrefutable evidence. And we've said to the client, if you want irrefutable evidence about which of these territories is the best one to take forward, you need another research methodology. So kind of blending the methodologies, I think, is really important as well. So what we do is we provide really rich, insightful, textural kind of opportunities, hypotheses, provocations. If they then want to be quantified, there's another methodology that can be used to do that.
How do you find that type of, I guess, brief, where it's not necessarily going into talk to kind of a 20, 30, 40 people, but it's actually around sharing some of the trends and observations that you see in the world.
There are strengths and weaknesses to it. I think the strengths are I can take every piece of information that we've found across all of our different interviews and share general themes and trends that we're spotting. Of course, the downside is I can't be very specific because a lot of the work that we do is confidential to particular clients. So coming up with specific examples sometimes is not allowed. I'm not allowed to do that. So I have to be quite careful with kind of how much I share. But those general themes, I think, become really interesting. I was chatting to somebody earlier about a project that we're thinking of kicking off, and I was saying to this person who we're going to be partnering with on this project, you're going to be an expert in this particular audience group when this project's finished. That's really valuable. That's really valuable in the organization in which you work now, but it's really valuable to you moving forward as an individual. So the inputs and outputs, I find it really interesting kind of using the inputs in a very thematic way without betraying any confidences. But then what I really like as well is engaging that side of my brain, the what-if side of my brain, the speculative side of my brain. And I find that a lot easier working as a kind of research consultant now, whereas when I was kind of ahead of strategy, I felt a lot more pressure to get it right. You know, there are many correct answers, but when you're stood in front of a client giving them a multi-stage five-year strategy, that's got to be incredibly rigorous and incredibly well thought out. And I used to feel that pressure when I was delivering those strategies. Now my role is, okay, here are some general themes and some trends. So what if you did something like this? Or what if you did something like that? I don't have to go into that detail for the five-year strategy, but I can share hypotheses and provocations and opportunities for that particular brand that might be useful to them.
And I think one of the things that makes you so incredible at what you do is your background in agency world too. You kind of understand the full life cycle of from, you know, ethnographic research, talking to people, kind of insights and provocations to what happens with them and where it goes. And I think that's really powerful because for the people that work with you, you know what's coming next for them. Before we move to the quick fire questions, I really want to ask you, can you speak to, like, are there any dream briefs that you really want to tackle? Like, let's manifest for 2024. Dream briefs, what would you wish people kind of are picking up the phone to kind of ask for your help with?
Interesting. More longitudinal, longer term pieces of work. So what people are tending to buy from us at the moment is a project by project basis. Please, can you tell us more about this audience? Or can you tell us more about how they're buying in this category or our particular brand, etc.? Then that's great. We can actually get a lot of stuff quite quickly and quite deeply from doing that. What I'm becoming really interested in is kind of human behavior ongoing. I think particularly this year is a really interesting year as well with the election, you know, and clients, you know, you might talk about that in the boardroom, they might not, but it plays a huge role in people's lives. So a longer term study, and in fact, there's a brief I'm chatting to a client at the moment where we've had verbal sign off. I'm hoping that we get official sign off where it's exactly this. It's chatting to the same people over the course of a year to understand how their lives are changing quarter on quarter in marketing language or season on season in human language. How are their lives different from spring to summer to autumn to winter? So if you think about how we differ from Christmas to summer, there are two extremes, summer holidays, we're outside more, our diets change, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas in winter, we hunker on down, our diets change probably for the worse, we don't go away, it's dark, so it's our energy levels are different. Now, all of those impact how people buy things, how they interact with each other, you know, kind of where they spend their time, mood. So tracking that over the course of a year, I'd love to do that more for more clients.
Amazing. Okay, Mark, quick fire time. I'm going to switch things up. Are you more a theoretical learner or a hands-on learner?
Hands-on, because I'm not intelligent enough to be theoretical. And I mean that absolutely sincerely. I'm not particularly well read. I didn't have the best education. So I love the thought of reading good books and I love buying good books. They're all sat on my shelf. I basically just get on with it and learn from my mistakes.
Do you have a favorite small talk topic to kick off an interview? And because we're British, is it the weather?
It can sometimes be the weather. A lot of the time it's just asking people to go through their day, actually. You know, because like I said, getting people to go through their day, you can actually unearth quite a lot. I wouldn't say it's small talk, but politics invariably kind of is brought up mostly by participants in every session because it's all invasive.
Can you please describe your taste in interior design?
I studied architecture as a degree, so it should be good. I did. It should be good, but it's not. So I'd say it's minimal. When I say IKEA inspired, I mean dominated by IKEA and vastly improved when my wife has anything to do with it.
Amazing. In another life, what would your career be?
The Northeastern in me wants to say a football player for Newcastle United. And I think the knees have gone now. And yeah, definitely right. For this, what would I rather be? I actually really enjoy what I'm doing. I would love to have lived in a different era, right? I was born at the end of the 70s, but for some reason I'm infatuated by the 1970s. I've read a lot of books and watched a lot of documentaries about the 1970s. And I would love to have had a career in the 70s. I don't know why.
Love it. What makes somebody a good traveling companion?
Their acceptance of me having noise-cancelling headphones. So it's like, it depends on the journey. I used to do a lot of toing and froing from Asia and across Asia. And there are different kinds of flights, work flights, non-work flights, like short-haul work flights, long-haul work flights. Getting the ratio of conversation to silence and alcohol, I always thought was the right. You need to get the blend right.
Like it. What was the first work thing you were really proud of?
I'm going to say two things, because one is a piece of work I did in Singapore for Guinness. We won an APAC FE Gold for it. Great piece of work, helped the business, humorous, like, amazing piece of work. Very, very proud of that as an output. But actually beyond that, I think the work I'm most proud of, particularly when I was in Singapore, was helping my team kind of thrive and survive, helping them achieve what they wanted to achieve. And I'm still in touch with a vast, vast majority of them. And I used to love working with teams all across Asia, just basically helping them. And my role as their, whatever you want to call it, I don't like the word manager, but mentor or whatever, was I always wanted to give them as much freedom as possible and tell them that I had their backs. So yeah, a piece of work for Guinness I'm really proud of, but then also kind of the impact I've hopefully had on people in their careers.
That's awesome. What was the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
I don't know if anybody's ever said this to me, but I had an epiphany a few years ago, 5-6 years ago. The pressure that I used to put on myself as a strategist to get the correct answer used to be crippling. Nausea, couldn't sleep, stress. And then I had an epiphany of, there are many correct answers. Our job as strategists and researchers, I'd argue, is not to find the correct answer. It's to find lots of answers that are in the arena of correct, and then just convincing a client that yours is a really good one by using various bits of evidence. The second bit of advice, I'm going to put this down to my mum, who's not around anymore, unfortunately. I don't even know whether she ever said it, but she can get the credit for it, which is never trust anybody who doesn't like chips.
I love that one. I've not heard that one before. I love that. Thank you for sharing that. And now this is the last question, Mark, and something we ask everyone. On a scale of 1 to 10, Mark Hadfield, how weird are you?
I am bang in the middle, number 5, very happily mainstream. Dependent upon my mood, I might do something that feels a bit out of place. But more often than not, I am Mr. Middle, and I am very happy with that.
Perfect. I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Mark, and talking about kind of Meet the 85% and what you do as a ethnographic researcher. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.